Coming up on Hear Me Out, if you're traveling on Route 2 in Iron River over the next few days, you may have some company. The Rainbow Gathering is happening just outside of town with 5,000 participants celebrating love, peace, and respect, which they say they hope to get from Forest Service Police.
They arrested me in Utah for filming an illegal search. My charges were dropped because the DA said that it was ridiculous.
Then, she's 8 feet tall, wearing dazzling red with green stripes and wonderfully willowy arms. And she's the official mascot for Chum's Rhubarb Festival in Duluth. And though she really can't talk, she has a lot to say. All that in a regional wrap-up of this week's news after this. Welcome to Hear Me Out, I'm Robin Washington. If you're traveling on Route 2 through Iron River for the next week, you may want to take it slow, and you may not have any choice in the matter. From July 1st through the 7th, the area will be the site of the 48th Annual Rainbow Gathering, or officially, the Rainbow Family of Living Light Gathering of the Tribes. The exact location is described as somewhere in the western Lake Superior region from the Nicolet Forest through the Chippewa Forest, including all national forests between. But I was directed to the site in the Shawamigan National Forest, starting on Route 2, then told to head south on County Road H and basically follow the signs. As many as 5,000 participants or more will be doing likewise, as they have in different locations around the country every year since 1972. Sometimes with as many as 10,000 people in the woods. The music and sounds you'll hear in this program are from previous Rainbow Gatherings, courtesy of the website soundsfromtherainbow.org. Their stated purpose is seeking peace, harmony, freedom, and respect. That last one is key because they say law enforcement, especially from the National Forest Service, hasn't always treated them respectfully. Earlier this week, I spoke with three attendees, Finch, Paradox, and Mark, all using single names only, though you could say that puts us on a first-name basis. We met on Route 2 and County Road H at the Scenic Station, which was doing a brisk business. So, we are talking to...
I'm Finch. We're in Iron River, Wisconsin, about 10, 12 miles away from the site of the 2019 annual Rainbow Gathering of the Tribes.
And why are you here?
I'm here to see all of my best friends and also to try and help make sure that all of the people that are coming into Wisconsin for this gathering have a smooth, safe, and healthy gathering.
You've gone to others before. I saw a video. How many have you gone to before?
This is my 60th Rainbow Gathering. This is my 13th annual Rainbow Gathering. I've also been to a couple in other countries, including Colombia, Taiwan, Germany, and Poland, as well as several regional gatherings around the United States.
So that totals 660.
Yep, it's a big birthday of mine. I'm probably going to try to have a party in the woods at some point about it.
What do you do when you're not rainbow gathering?
I go on Grateful Dead tour sometimes, and I sell enamel hat pins for the band. I've also done petition collecting, signature gathering for ballot initiatives. I get work while I can, where I can, and I travel on a very shoestring budget for a lot of the year.
I hate to ask this kind of stereotypical question, but what's the difference between a rainbow gathering and a Grateful Dead concert?
Well, at a Grateful Dead concert, there are a lot of people that are making their way across the country by selling things and by making artisan crafts and selling them in front of the concert. And also, the Grateful Dead is based very strongly on, like, a really wonderful but really loud, amplified musical set. The Rainbow Gathering doesn't do any electricity, and all of our music is cooperative, acoustic, around the fire, and there's no money at a Rainbow Gathering exchanged, except in our communal donation hat, the magic hat, which is used to buy bulk food for the gathering.
What about you? What brings you here?
I'm Paradox. I'm here to cook food and spend time with my family. And we spend most of our year doing disaster relief and responding to natural disasters and setting up a free food kitchen. We also do farm work. We travel, and I've got three children and a wife, and we live full-time in our bus. So we do a lot of agricultural work to keep the kitchen on the road. But we mainly come to Rainbow Gatherings to feed people. It's kind of a natural extension of what we do anyways. So.
Where is home?
Home is the woods, being in the forest with our family, and but we live full time in a school bus, so converted school bus.
Mark, do you feel like hopping in?
Yeah.
Hello, and we are talking to.
My name's Mark.
Why are you here?
I was called to it. This is a wonderful thing, and simply I was called to it.
How many have you gone to before?
My first was Montana, which I think was 2013.
Paradox, how many times? I didn't ask you.
I have been to four national gatherings or annual gatherings and around 20 regional gatherings.
So where did they start? When?
The first Rainbow Gathering was near Granby, Colorado in 1972, and it had been planned for about 2 years after an event called Vortex One, which was a free festival in Portland that has an interesting but rather long story behind it.
What's the difference between Rainbow Gathering and Burning Man?
Well, again, the money thing. Burning Man has a ticket price of upwards of $400, and Rainbow does not charge anyone anything at the door. They have their similarities in that both of them are build-your-own communities, and they really shine when people that attend them participate instead of expecting other people to create something for them. Burning Man is more focused on art, and it has a lot of robotics and electricity and electronic-created music, and the Rainbow Gatherings are a lot more back to nature. We don't do electricity or generators, and the artwork and fun and games that we create is all by hand.
So from your video last year and just going online and looking what the police had to say, the authorities don't seem to have the same point of view of the gatherings as the participants.
There's an agency called the Incident Command Team, sometimes called the National Incident Management Team, that is under the auspices of the Department of Agriculture, and every year they get a $500,000 budget for law enforcement of the Rainbow Gathering, and they use this to systematically profile, spy on, and harass us.
What's the worst thing that's happened?
Can I touch on the subject of harassment? This year, coming into the gathering, we were followed by several law enforcement vehicles for over 7 miles. When they finally pulled us over, they made up a story about me blowing a stop sign, which wasn't factually correct at all. They proceeded to run drug dogs on my school bus. I watched the officer smack his toy into the door to signal for the dog to hit on the vehicle. They then proceeded to make my wife and my toddlers and my newborn baby get out on the side of the road, and they systematically destroyed our bus. They dumped, we had over 3,000 pounds of food on board because we do a kitchen at the gathering. They dumped every single container of food that we had out on the ground. They smashed 30 pounds of produce into the wood floors on our school bus. Completely destroyed it. It took us an entire day to sort and clean and organize. Not mentioning the hundreds of dollars worth of items that they probably thousands of dollars worth of items that they damaged and destroyed. And of course, their search yielded nothing. We always abide by the law. And we would never, carry contraband in our vehicles. My children and my children's safety is the most important thing to me. My kids were crying. My wife is crying. It was so humiliating. We were all being patted down and searched. It was just really horrible.
Do you know what agency that was?
That was the National Forest Service.
And that's the same that you showed in your video from last year, was it?
Yes, there are about 36 federal officers that come from different forests around the country that are the regular incident command team. And then each year, the incident command team also comprises of the different agencies that they coordinate with, including the local sheriffs and state's offices. It's not just the same type of people, it's the same people. As soon as I drove into the gathering this year, I was immediately greeted by a dozen police officers that waved at me and yelled, "Hi, Finch." Since we've had brush-ins before, they arrested me in Utah for filming an illegal search. My charges were dropped because the DA said that it was ridiculous and that obviously they arrested me because they were irritated. And then last year, the video you referred to, I was stopped at a mandatory checkpoint, which I'm led to believe is unconstitutional. They wouldn't give me a reason why I had actually violated any laws or statutes to pull me over. And while I was asking if I could go, they put the drug dogs around my car and did the same business. They told the dogs to alert. They took everything out of my car and put it on the ground for about 30 minutes. I videotaped it. They found nothing. They pulled a lockbox, a locked cash box that belonged to my passenger out of the car and demanded the keys. And when we refused, instead of getting a warrant, which would have been the correct way to go about it, they simply forced it open, damaging the property, and they also found nothing. So the fact that they were greeting me by name as soon as they saw me, in my opinion, was an attempt at intimidation and harassment, the equivalent of saying, "We know you're here, we know what car you drive, we know the moment you arrive."
What about you, Mark?
You can understand with those two stories how it's impossible to start fresh. I mean, it's no way for us to wipe our memories of what's happened. It's impossible for the incident command team to all of a sudden change. They're the same people. So if somehow the entire incident command team got replaced, that would be one thing. But what happens is they come year after year. It's, in my opinion, it's something like a vacation for them. They get to come out and get out into the woods and all this sort of stuff, and they seem to enjoy harassing us. So unless that entire structure changed, I wouldn't see how our interactions could possibly change.
I would be open to the incident command team being replaced by resource officers exclusively. We have a really good relationship with the resource department of forestry, and I think if the forestry and if the federal government wanted to start fresh with us, they could staff their incident command team with members of the conservation teams instead of law enforcement.
And I have another suggestion. This might be a controversial one, but our President Donald Trump actually said one thing that I agree with, which is that the United States National Forest doesn't need to waste the Department of Agriculture's budget on law enforcement when all of that law enforcement could actually be handled by the local sheriff's department. And in my experience, when we've had the ability to interact with the sheriffs at the Rainbow Gathering, we've had a quite good working relationship with them. And usually that lasts for 5 or 6 days until the incident command team arrives from Washington and the sheriff's department is forced to sign what's called a delegation of authority. And then the incident command team takes over the movie.
Have they, in all fairness to them, have they ever found anything?
Every now and then they find things like small amounts of marijuana in people's cars, but like the number of times that those things were found in illegal searches, we find that even when there is contraband, anyone that pleads not guilty historically almost always has their cases dismissed. The problem is that the Forest Service prefers to make it easier for people to plead no contest by giving them very small fines, $40, something like that, in exchange for a no contest plea, and then they can say that they gave out however many hundred citations and they were all convictions, and this justifies their $500,000 budget for the following year. I was just at the Bayfield County Courthouse in Washburn. We had 21 tickets for 17 people, and the judge told us that if anybody chose to plead not guilty, they would be required to come to their trial date on August 23rd at 10 a.m. in Madison, Wisconsin, which is very difficult for most of us to get to because many people come from all around the country to Rainbow, but even local people from Iron River would have a hard time getting all the way to Madison. It seems very funny to me since the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees us a right to a trial in the district of the crime that was committed.
So is it all worth it? Still coming out to it?
I wouldn't be at my 60th gathering if it wasn't. I mean, after you get arrested once, if it's not worth it, you probably don't come back. But the gathering is one of the most fulfilling and exciting and fun things in my life right now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it doesn't matter. I expect it to be harassed each and every year, and each and every year we're, you know, go above and beyond to make sure that everything's legal, that we don't have tail lights out, or, you know, registration is up to date. And it doesn't matter. Every year we're harassed, and every year we'll come back because, you know, this is, you know, I view myself as, you know, a brother and sister of all humans on this planet, and the woods and nature is my home and my church, and so to gather with you know, my family, and to be able to feed them and to be able to commune the way that we do without the pressures of you know, commercialism and being sold things, it's just it's one of the most beautiful, one of the most fulfilling things that's ever happened to me in my life. Even when harassed, and even when jailed, and even when persecuted, it is absolutely worth it.
You've been jailed for this?
I have been jailed over activities involving rainbow gatherings, you know, not paying tickets for citations where I was cited for, you know, improper food storage, or, you know, they have a litany of things that they like to, you know, cite people for. If you got a bunch of bananas, you know, sitting out on top of a cooler, they'll write you a ticket for improper food storage.
I guess so. The question is, why do we keep coming back? Because it's just amazing how much good is done. It's amazing when you see some of these kids that really walk in and you can just see the weight and the heaviness on their shoulders. And a lot of times this is, you know, these people never been to Rainbow before. They've heard about this thing, and they come into the woods and you can just see the weight on them. And you give them a week and you can see it get lifted a little bit higher. And it's just amazing. By the time you leave the woods, your family, you've gone from a place where you feel like nobody in the world loves you, where you're alone, where there's, you don't have friends, you don't have a tribe, you don't have a kind, and you found it. You found family. You found your tribe. I don't think that there's anything in the world that's better than being able to connect people to other people, to be able to unlock their own self-worth and potential.
And so what
we do.
What is exactly happens?
Oh, all kinds of things happen. The focus of the gathering is on July 4th when we have the giant prayer for peace. And usually the gathering has a morning of silence from sunup until noon. People are encouraged to meditate or pray for peace in their own way. Sometimes that way is simply silently cooking pancakes for the other people who are meditating and praying. And at around noon, we gather in a giant circle around our main meadow common area, and we hold hands and we say Om, which is a sacred sound to a lot of people, and break the silence. And then a parade of children from Kitty Village enters the circle with streamers and banners and costumes and face paint, singing. And they get to the center of the circle, and we complete our Om, and then it's a giant celebration for the rest of the day with watermelons and drums. But for the rest of the gathering, mostly what we do is keep the village safe and functional, which involves a lot of gathering and chopping wood for fires, and gathering, filtering, and boiling water for coffee, tea, dishwater, soup. And so we have kitchens, camps that are structured in the form of free community food kitchens, and community forms around them. People choose which camp or kitchen they feel a good vibe from, and they volunteer with that kitchen. And so people who feel the responsibility to help plug in and keep the gathering moving along are doing a lot of those things. A lot of food gets cooked and served for free. We have gourmet chefs in the woods. We have some of the most amazing, delicious stir fries and fried things and soups and salads. Our common meal is vegan and vegetarian, but the kitchens serve whatever they choose to out of their own space.
So what about the people in the communities where you go? Have you had any relationships come out of them?
Last year at Georgia, the last private property owners coming into the National Forest, they owned a ranch and they were the last private property. They came and, you know, just with the intention of checking it out, since we were, you know, practically in their backyard, and they were elderly, affluent. And, you know, came with the intention of staying for a day and checking it out. They ended up coming back, setting up a camp near the kid village, bringing their horses and giving the kids horseback rides. They stayed the entire gathering, and it was really beautiful. We actually installed the peace pole in their living room after the gathering. And it was just a wonderful experience, and wonderful people who are now our family.
You know, I guess the funny thing is, I was talking about the Forest Service and the incident command and how big of a pain in the butt they are. The forest supervisors have actually been some of the people that I have continued to communicate with after gatherings. And so I find that kind of interesting. But we definitely that's one of my lasting things. I've worked with supervisors in the past, and I have kept up some of those relationships.
We're talking to Finch, Paradox, and Mark, three experienced participants in the annual Rainbow Gathering. So, Finch, why Iron River?
There's actually a funny story, I think, about why Iron River. In 1993, there ended up being a split gathering where some of the Rainbow Gathering went to Kentucky and some of it went to Alabama. And the way we decide where to go the following year is we sit in an open circle, a discussion that we call Vision Council, and pass a talking object around until we reach a unanimous decision on where we should go next. But that year there were two Vision Councils because there were two sites, and one of them chose to go to Wyoming the following year and one of them chose to go to Wisconsin. And throughout the year, the family networked and figured it out together so they wouldn't have to have a split forever, and the gathering went to Wyoming. But ever since then, for the last 25 years, individuals from that Vision Council have come to our Vision Council requesting and pleading that the family honor their consensus and bring us to Wisconsin. And last year, after 10 days of discussion, we decided to give Wisconsin another chance, and this time we finally found a beautiful site that has all of the things that we need to sustain a healthy several thousand person population for a few weeks, namely water that we can filter on a mass scale, and parking that we can park several hundred cars in, open spaces for camping, firewood for burning, and a big meadow for us to commune in on the 4th of July.
Okay, and how many people do you expect?
It's so hard to tell. Our population's been declining for the last couple of years for various reasons. We initially thought it would be 8,000 to 10,000 people. Now my expectations are that 3,000 to 5,000 people will show up.
Still a little bit bigger than Iron River.
But much smaller than Burning Man.
Ah, okay. All right. That was Finch, Paradox, and Mark, participants in the Rainbow Gathering taking place from July 1st through the 7th in the Shawamigan National Forest, just outside of Iron River. As many as 5,000 participants are expected, with the stated goals of seeking peace, harmony, freedom, and respect. That last quality is a bone of contention among Rainbow Gathering members, who say they aren't always treated respectfully from Forest Service law enforcement. Coming up, for the National Forest Service point of view, Shawamigan Nicolet Public Affairs Officer Hillary Markin. I'm Robin Washington. This is Hear Me Out.
How you been?
How you been?
It's been a long time since you didn't want to be my friend. You just walked away, didn't say you'd ever be back again. How you been?
How you been?
It's been a long time since you told me it had to end. But you know
Whatever you can find lying around or whistling is good too. Here we go.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. That's music from a previous Rainbow Gathering, courtesy of the website soundsfromtherainbow.org. Before the break, we heard from Finch, Paradox, and Mark, participants in the Rainbow Gathering taking place from July 1st through the 7th in the Shawamigan National Forest outside Iron River. As many as 5,000 participants are expected, with the stated goals of seeking peace, harmony, freedom, and respect. That last quality is a bone of contention among Rainbow Gathering members who say they aren't always treated respectfully from Forest Service law enforcement. For the National Forest Service point of view, I spoke with Shawamigan Nicolet Public Affairs Officer Hillary Markin. I had a conversation with our Rainbow Gathering friends, and two stories they told me. One told of a story of being followed by... they were referring specifically to what they called the National Incident Management Team as police. So I don't know if there's a particular part of the team that's police or not, but that's what they were referring to. Is there a specific part of the Forest Service police that is dedicated to the Rainbow National Gatherings?
So we have a National Incident Management Team for the event, and our team objectives is to address the health and safety risks to the public and participants. To minimize the environmental impacts, we have law enforcement presence to help with that. You know, we work in partnership with state, county, and local law enforcement, health officials, and other organizations. You know, anytime you have this large of a gathering of people coming to an area, you know, you do have public safety concerns and for the health and safety of everybody in that area. And so we do have that incident management team. There is a law enforcement component to that where we're working with all the cooperating agencies. Again, it's a large influx of people coming to an area. You know, we want to make sure the health and safety of everybody that's attending that area and everybody in the area and visitors and that are coming to the National Forest that are coming up to the Bayfield County area. You know, it's a busy time of year.
Right. Okay. So part of that team is a police force that's within that team, or is it that they work with the Forest Service police that are in the particular areas?
Right. So we kind of have two different sides of our incident management team. We have a law enforcement side of our incident management team, which includes Forest Service law enforcement as well as officers from other entities. And then we have, you know, our Forest Service side, which is more kind of our resource advisors and things like that that are out there ensuring that the natural resources are protected in conjunction with law enforcement.
Okay. And their specific complaint about the police part of the team is they said that they were a bit more aggressive, or they didn't say a bit, they said they were more aggressive in enforcing rules to them, more so than, they said, local police, or they said other Forest Service police.
So, yeah, and all visitors to the National Forest must abide by all local, state, and federal laws. You know, again, we do have law enforcement out there, just like we do on every other normal day. There's law enforcement out patrolling to make sure that everybody is abiding by those laws that are in place.
Right. One other specific complaint was that the police would follow them for some significant period of time. They said one instance was 7 miles to see if they were doing anything wrong or waiting until they did something wrong. The person who said this said actually he didn't do anything wrong. Is that typical? Or?
So there's only very few roads out there that are traveling through this area to get to the gathering. There's, you know, only a couple different entrance routes. They're small, very narrow roads. And then the road up through the area is very narrow, is one-way traffic. So, you know, there's only kind of one course of travel that folks can take in and out of the area. And again, you know, it goes back to all visitors to the National Forest or anywhere need to abide by all the local, state, and federal laws, you know, when they're visiting an area or where they live. So that's just standard protocol there.
Mm-hmm. Something that kind of supports that is I talked to somebody who lives in Iron River, and they said they brought out some water to the Rainbow Gathering, and then that they were stopped on the way back for not making a left turn signal in the forest, which they said apparently they've not done that before, but this time it was enforced. Any commentary on that?
you know, again, it's, you know, the laws are in place. We all need to abide by them. And, you know, there are consequences if we don't. And that's, I guess, you know, that's why we have the state, local, and federal laws to be as following.
Right. Actually, as I ask the question, it occurs to me that perhaps the reason he wasn't stopped before is because there wasn't anybody out there to stop him. So that might.
Right, exactly.
And you clearly do have a higher presence with the large number of people there.
We do, and that would be, you know, the same for any large festival or large gathering of people. There would be a higher law enforcement aspect, and if there's, you know, a fire or something like that, you know, the storms that are rolling through, trees are down, we need to be able to get equipment and resources out there to ensure, you know, the health and safety of everybody that's attending the gathering.
Right. Oh, another complaint was that when they are searched, that stuff is not put back into their vans or buses or whatever their vehicle is, and I saw some video of this where it indeed is pretty much all over the roadway, and an officer responds that's not their responsibility to put it back.
I don't have any information on that. I'm not familiar with those practices.
That was in Georgia, I think, last year or somewhere. Oh, okay. Like that. And then, as you were talking about health and safety, you've got thousands of people, as you were pointing out. So, you know, people do what people have to do, and one area is sanitary. So do I understand they're digging latrines?
Correct. They have, yes, they pretty much put in, they call it a slit trench, and then that they have a latrine-type thing over top of the slit trench.
And I did hear a question from somebody in town saying she wasn't so sure that the forest could handle that.
So the Forest Service requires a special use permit for every public group of 75 people or more that's going to be attending an event or a meeting on National Forest. The Rainbow family has consistently refused to comply with our permit process, meaning they don't come into our offices, ask for an application, and fill it out. And so what we've done is we've worked with them. We've, you know, in the past gatherings, we've cited them for failure to obtain a permit. But in lieu of all of that, you know, they're still attending, even besides all of that taking place. We work with them to create what we call a resource protection plan. And so as part of that includes the health and safety of individuals. And we are out there kind of on the ground working with them on where they can place some of these things, you know, to protect the natural resources that are out there. You know, such as water quality, and try to help with the sanitation issues to ensure that there's minimal damage to the landscape. And so we are out there, you know, our resource advisors, we call them, are out there working with gathering members to try to minimize the environmental damage and impact from such a large gathering.
And this is the first time, I know there was a smaller one in Wisconsin a couple of years ago?
Yeah, back in 2017, they had a smaller one down to the south a little ways.
Something in the hundreds of people, not thousands, correct?
Correct, yep. And we worked with them, again, in a very similar fashion to, you know, have a resource protection kind of plan in place, worked with them on where they can park, and, you know, like throughout the gathering, because it was a much smaller scale, but we were working with them to ensure that, you know, the health and safety and the protection of the natural resources for that gathering as well.
So were you surprised to hear the large one was happening here?
That's, you know, it's always interesting how they kind of choose their location. You know, they scout it out, and then they have a, as they call it, a spring council, and then they announce the location. And it's usually not revealed to the Forest Service until right when it happens. So it's been an interesting adventure trying to get everything in place and kind of help manage something like this that's going to bring that many people to an area.
Sure. So it's not a matter of you being surprised. The whole point is to surprise the entire Forest Service, it sounds like.
Yes.
Right. And they told me that, actually, just an interesting tidbit, that Wisconsin was an early choice, but it got outvoted by another location. And so it's always been there as kind of an asterisk. Gee, we should go to Wisconsin someday. So it was long overdue. And
oh, interesting.
Now you get to experience it. So.
Yeah, and I think they had one in Michigan one year, maybe Minnesota one other time. So,
we've been talking to Hillary Markin, who is the Public Affairs Officer for the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Forest Service and Rainbow Gathering participants aren't the only ones affected by the group's visit. I stopped in at a few local establishments to get the point of view of regular townsfolk in Iron River about the possible quintupling, if that's the proper word, of their community's population of 1,100 for a week-plus event. Here's what they had to say.
We've had a lot of the Rainbow Gathering friends in, and they have been nothing but pleasant. They've been awesome in our restaurant. I have nothing bad to say about them at all.
So even though they're back to nature, they eat pizza.
They do eat pizza. A lot of them are getting our vegetarian pizza, but they do eat pizza. They've been in here. They've been awesome. They've been over the top nice. It's been great.
Good tippers?
Yes, actually, very good tippers, which was not, I mean, surprising, I suppose, but yes, very good tippers.
And you are?
Desiree Sipsis.
And I am at where again?
The Pizza Parlor, Iron River Pizza Parlor.
Terry Patash.
Yep.
And we are at the
Scenic Drive Resort.
Okay.
Delta. Yeah.
And you're going to have a few neighbors for the next couple of weeks or something.
That's the way it sounds. But yeah, that's fine, you know, as long as everything goes good. It's not hurting me any.
You think it might help any?
You know, to tell you the truth, I don't know what I would do if all of a sudden 300, 400, 500 of them come walking in here and want to eat. That's just not going to happen. I mean, it's bad enough when you're sitting here and, you know, 40 or 50 ATVs come rolling in.
Right. You know, as a surprise.
As a surprise, you know, and it's a good surprise, but, you know, don't get me wrong, but it's just, it's a lot to take in all at once, you know what I mean?
Do you know much about the area that they're going into?
Yep, we hike there all the time.
Do you think it's prepared for like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people?
You know, I think this land is very forgiving and accepting, and if they treat it right, everything will be fine.
All right. Well, they are back to nature, right?
That's right. They are.
I'm Robin Washington. Could I get your name?
My name's Robin, too.
Donna Schultz of Iron River said unlike many of her neighbors, she's quite familiar with Rainbow Gatherings because she knows a young man who's attended several.
And I would trust him with anything.
Really?
Yes.
What about the...
You would pick him out in a crowd as someone unusual looking. And maybe react. But I think to each his own. They say they come in peace. Let's let them be.
Those were comments of Iron River residents about the Rainbow Gathering set to take place for 9 days beginning July 1st. Coming up, she's 8 feet tall, decked out in red with green stripes and, shall we say, leafy arms, and the star of another big celebration in the region this week. I'm Robin Washington. This is Hear Me Out.
Rhubarb pie. It might rain tomorrow. Let it get some before I die. Rhubarb pie. Rhubarb pie. I was in the kitchen, setting out the windowsill. Talk about make my eyes bug out. Lord, it surely will. Rhubarb pie, it might rain tomorrow, could it get some before it dies? Oh, Lord.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. That was Dan Fogarty singing about rhubarb. If it sounds like he knows what he's talking about, he can't hold a candle to my next guest, and he probably shouldn't. She's 8 feet tall, wearing dazzling red with green stripes and wonderfully willowy arms, and she's the official mascot for Chum's Rhubarb Festival in Duluth tomorrow. Joining me in the studio is the one and only Rue Barbara, who, okay, she doesn't actually talk, but she's brought all sorts of devices to tell us what she's thinking. And joining her as translator is Chum's executive director, Lee Stewart. Welcome, Rue Barbara. And welcome, Lee.
Thank you so much for having us here, Robin.
So I have to ask, Rue Barbara, your name, I keep getting confused. Sometimes it comes out as Rue Barbarella from some old Jane Fonda movies or Barbara Ann or something like that. Where'd you get Rue Barbara from? Uh-huh. Lee, can you tell us what's going on here?
Yeah, she gets very sensitive about her name. She's known as Rue Barbara. And it's spelled R-H-U, then Barbara, B-A-R-B-A-R-A. There used to be a rhubarb, and she's kind of sad about that, so that's sensitive on the name, too.
Mm-hmm. And can I be, I know this might be a sensitive subject, too, but you're a bit tall. Exactly how tall are you?
About 8 feet tall.
Wow.
So I have to bend over. I get my hair messed up a bit.
I noticed that when you came in the studio here, you had to bend down to get through the door. Why rhubarb? Why not? Okay, yes, I should have known that.
Well, it's a little bit more than why not. It's also, well, rhubarb is a vegetable of the north, and it's resilient, and you can't stop it, and that's kind of like chum. Rhubarb is abundance. Chum believes in abundance. Rhubarb is generous. Chum believes in generosity.
So take me back. When did it start? Oh, actually, I meant that question for Lee.
Oh, well, rhubarb interrupted there. So this is the 15th annual Rhubarb Festival. And as a chum fundraiser, it works really well because everybody has a lot of rhubarb. They want to get rid of it. They feel bad about not using it. They can give it to us. We will build 1,100 or 1,200 pies with it, make rhubarb ice cream. It takes 15 pounds of rhubarb to make rhubarb ice cream. And then we sell it back to people in the form of pies, crisps, at a markup. And it works really well. Rhubarb multiplies itself.
Hmm. Well, I'm not going to ask a question about that. So, and Rue Barbara, have you been part of the festival since the beginning?
No, but about 8 years.
And how did you join? Were you just wandering through Duluth, or are you from Duluth?
Kind of. I was born on the University of Minnesota Duluth campus in the art department. She wants me to remind you, too, that UMD has also planted 3 acres of rhubarb to contribute to the Rhubarb Festival every year.
Ah.
And this is the second year it's being harvested.
You just said a bunch of stuff you can make out of rhubarb, and I've actually experienced a rhubarb daiquiri for, I'm sure you're not serving that, not alcoholic beverages at this fest, but I'm wrong. But, yeah.
Yes, there are rhubarb cocktails at Dublin's, and we had some at Sir Ben's as well.
Uh-huh. And what else might I not think of?
Well, it depends on how many times you've been to the Rhubarb Festival, whether or not you think of it. So rhubarb brats, rhubarb salsa, rhubarb burritos, rhubarb breakfast sausage, a whole lot of sweets of rhubarb. But she does want me to remind people that in Persian culture, rhubarb is used often as a savory dish, and you can make chicken stew with it really nicely. I actually had to teach Rue Barbara about that. She thought it was all sweets. I think you can poach chicken in rhubarb juice. You can make chili with it. I won a second prize in a chili contest once with rhubarb, Texas red rhubarb chili.
So tell me more about the festival. What else can I expect?
Okay, so the festival opens at 9:15 with the rhubarb prayer. This is on Saturday, June 29th, on London Road behind First Lutheran Church. It's the 1100 block. Right, so I know. So people will start lining up well before 8:45. So we're going to run the festival from 9 to 3, stage shows all day long, food booths, kids booths. We have the robotics team there. We have coloring contests. We have a kids run. We have a climbing wall. We have Rigadoon kicking off in the morning. We have the fish heads closing in the afternoon. So we have a wide range of music attracting all kinds of people. And then I, Lee Stewart speaking, I will be giving a rhubarb cooking demonstration at some point during the day.
Okay. How does it help your bottom line and for what you do?
Well, it's Chum's biggest fundraiser of the year, but it's more of it's as much a community builder as it is a fundraiser. All this week, from Chum congregations throughout Duluth, people are chopping strawberries, chopping rhubarb, making rhubarb juice, making rhubarb pies. I was over at First Lutheran Church the other day. They make most of the pie crusts for the 1,100 pies. First United Methodist makes their own crust. And there was a whole freezer full that said, Pilgrim, 50, Gloria Day, 50, Holy Rosary, 300. And so people take quotas, they gather together, and they make pies for rhubarb. And then it's a large fundraiser for us. We raise about $60,000 a year at the Rhubarb Festival.
All right. Well, we've been talking to Rue Barbara and her translator, Lee Stewart, the executive director of CHUM. CHUM is the acronym formerly standing for Churches United in Ministry, or invariably referred to as Central Hillside United Ministries, and now is simply CHUM. CHUM is best known for operating the largest homeless shelter in Duluth and other services for those experiencing poverty. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Robin Washington, and this is Hear Me Out.
I want another slice of a rhubarb tart. I want another lovely slice. I'm not disparaging the blueberry pie, but rhubarb. rhubarb tart is oh so very nice.
Welcome back to Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. And Danielle Kading joins us for the roundup of this week's regional news.
Hi, Danny? Robin.
Hey,
how
hi.
Are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. It's right. been a scorcher this week.
It happens occasionally in Superior, Wisconsin.
Yeah. Unseasonably warm.
We'll take it.
Yeah. Well, in the news this week, the remarks of a Superior city councilor have led to legal action from the city's attorney. The city's attorney is claiming comments about the quality of his work rise to the level of slander and libel. City Attorney Frog Prell filed a notice of claim against Councilor Jenny Van Sickle this week following comments she posted on Twitter about his work. The tweet said Prell has a, quote, long-established reputation of repugnant incompetence. Van Sickle was questioning a legal opinion he provided to the council in a review of methods that could be used to resolve a dispute over selecting the body's president. Prell's attorney Jeff Scott Olson says her comments could be damaging to his reputation.
So we wanted to protect Mr. Prell's right to go forward with damages litigation in the future, should he choose to do that.
Councilor Van Sickle said in an email, quote, I don't worship every person that holds power at City Hall, and I intend to keep working to redistribute that power to people who have been left out for too long. The comments against the city's attorney sparked a move by city councilors to censure Van Sickle at their last council meeting, but Superior Mayor Jim Payne vetoed it. Payne says Van Sickle didn't break any rules.
If we're just going to start bringing in our personal grievances or our political disagreements and start punishing each other on the council floor for what we think and say, we will have dissolved into complete dysfunction.
Payne says the council and staff need to be able to work together and build a respectful environment. Superior City Council President Brent Fennessy agrees. Fennessy says the dispute over choosing a council president, censure, and Van Sickle's Twitter comments have been a distraction.
And hopefully we can all put this behind us. We can all move forward with civility and respect and continue to do the things that we've been elected to do.
Prell's attorney says he has 3 years to move forward with a defamation lawsuit against Van Sickle if he chooses to do so.
You know, this whole controversy of the Superior City Council has been going on for a while. You know what my opinion is on this?
What's that, Robin?
I don't have one. But I do have an opinion about a major part of this incarnation of it, which is Twitter. Have you ever sent a tweet that really improved the world?
I cannot say that I have.
Well, and I don't think that there's a deficiency on your part. I think it has something to do with the medium. Or have you heard of a politician sending a tweet that made things better?
You know, I can think of one politician in particular that makes tweets headline news on a regular basis.
Well, maybe that does make it better. After all, we're talking about them. We have something to enjoy at coffee clutches and keep us all busy, right?
Keep us talking anyway.
And apparently in this case, I'll say this much is something of an opinion. Give our lawyers something to do, too.
Yeah.
Right. What else we got there that has nothing to do with tweets?
Well, Fraser Shipyards in Superior was cited again for a safety violation this winter. The Duluth News Tribune reports that the federal government's worker safety arm issued 3 citations in March after an employee was struck by falling steel plates in February. The U.S. Occupational Health and Safety Administration said the steel plates were not rigged safely and that equipment wasn't used to keep workers at a safe distance away. The shipyard is considered a severe violator by the agency because of repeated violations. Last year, 60 workers reached a $7.5 million settlement with Fraser after being exposed to unsafe lead levels while working on the Herbert C. Jackson several years ago. OSHA and the shipyard reached a $700,000 settlement in that case. The Duluth newspaper reports the shipyard paid a roughly $9,200 fine related to the worker incident this winter. Bayfield County reopened County Highway N between Barnes and Drummond this week. County officials raised the road after water flooded it again this spring. The county raised a section of the road last fall due to flooding from high water levels on nearby Pigeon Lake. Last year's flooding on Father's Day weekend and wet weather this spring have caused water levels to rise significantly on the lake, which has no inlet or outlet. Also, the Bayfield County Cervid Study Committee made its final report and recommendations to the county board this week. The committee has been studying the impacts of chronic wasting disease on deer farms and wild deer. The committee was formed after concerns rose related to a Bayfield County deer farm owned by Dirk and Jane Stoltz. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported last year that the Stoltzes moved 23 deer from their farm in Washington County to their Bayfield County Preserve. State and federal officials killed 22 deer on the preserve in April last year after a deer in the Washington County herd tested positive for CWD. A report from the Bayfield County Committee issued multiple recommendations for dealing with CWD, including an ordinance to limit live animals that can be moved to the county. The recommendations also included developing a deer farm fencing ordinance to comply with DNR standards and require annual inspections, as well as require double fencing for new deer farms. The committee also recommended the county develop programs to support more CWD testing and proper carcass disposal. Recommendations will go to committees for review and be brought back before the full board at the county's July 30th meeting. A northern Wisconsin tribe says a Canadian energy firm's pipeline running through its reservation is at risk of becoming exposed. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa has been pushing Enbridge to remove its aging Line 5 pipeline from its lands. The Bad River Tribe decided 2 years ago not to renew easements on some tracts of land with Enbridge. Tribal Council member Dylan Jennings says the tribe has been working with independent experts to provide a report assessing the pipeline's integrity and its surroundings. Jennings declined to say who wrote the report or what it contained, except to say that changes to the river are prompting concern over the pipeline's location.
What we're finding is as the river begins to kind of oxbow off right in this area where the pipe is, the pipe is getting dangerously close to the eroding shore.
Jennings says the pipeline, which runs underneath the Bad River, is at risk of being exposed to high water flows and debris. An Enbridge spokeswoman said in a statement that the pipeline has been operating safely through the reservation and they continue to work toward a mutually beneficial resolution. And that's a look back on some of the news of the week.
Great. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
That's it for this edition of Hear Me Out. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more music, courtesy of SoundsFromTheRainbow.org.